Tonight is March the 4th, and we are in Yechezkel. We are in Perek Chavtes, chapter 29 in Yechezkel. This is a brand new topic. Now, this chapter is significant because it is the Haftorah for Parshas Va'era. We didn't read it that long ago. It was only a few weeks ago that we read Parshas Va'era, and this is the Haftorah because it deals with Mitzrayim, and since those Parshios, Shmos, Va'era, Bo, and the Shalach all deal with Mitzrayim, so Parshas Va'era and Bo each have a Haftorah that deals with Mitzrayim. Va'era is this one, Bo comes from Sefer Yirmiyah. So this one, with the entire chapter, is read then. So that's another way to get information about this, is to look in Parshas Va'era, the Haftorah. So the Navi says, "Bashanah ha'asiris bo'asiri b'shnei masor ha'chodesh hayad v'ashem elai leimar." In the 10th year, in the 10th month, the 12th day of the month, the word of Hashem was to me saying. Now, when the 10th year from what?
Exile.
Okay, from which
exile? From the first exile.
Right. Now, when was the Beis HaMikdash destroyed? In the 11th year. So this is the year prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, what is the 10th month? Which month is that?
Nisan is the first month.
That's right.
So it's two before Nisan.
Shabbat.
Shabbat is the 11th.
Okay.
Teves. Okay. So this is the 12th of Teves. Now you know that the 10th of Teves is a fast day. Mm-hmm. We talked about that when we had the 10th of Teves. That was the day that the enemy surrounded the walls of Yerushalayim. The siege began on the 10th of Teves. But it was the 10th of Teves in the 9th year. And this, well, in the 9th year, yeah, because it was then 2.5 years later that the destruction happened. This is the 10th year on the 12th of Teves. So the siege has now been going on for a little over a year when he gets this nevuah. Now we know that Yechezkel wasn't there in the city. He was in Bavel. He was in Bavel along with those who had been taken into Galus already 10 years previously. But that is where he is. Now let's review. We're going to need to know this. Let's review the years so we can all be on the same page. I know we've talked about this several times in Yechezkel, but we're going to use year one as... Okay. Year one will be the year that Nebuchadnezzar became king over Bavel. In year one, we're not going to go through as much details we've gone through in the past, but in year one, he became king over Bavel, and in year two, he conquered Yerushalayim for the first time. In his second year of his reign, he conquered Yerushalayim for the first time. And we know that there was a whole bunch of times that he came to Yerushalayim because he set up a puppet king, and then he came back. We went through this before. The Beis HaMikdash is actually destroyed in Nebuchadnezzar's 19th year, which is 18 years after the first time he sacked Yerushalayim. The first Galus, the one that Yechezkel went into Galus for, is 11 years prior to that, which would be the 7th or 8th year. You know, it's the 8th year from when Nebuchadnezzar took power, the 7th year since the first time that Yerushalayim was conquered. Here, it's the 10th year since then. So we're talking now in the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, one more year before the Beis HaMikdash is going to be destroyed. Actually, a year and a half before the Beis HaMikdash is going to be destroyed. Now, we need to know this, not at this point, but later on in the Perek, we're going to need to know this information, and we'll review it when we get there. But that's to orient ourselves to where we are. So the word of Hashem was to me, to Yechezkel, saying, Ben Adam, son of man, Sim panecha al paro melech Mitzrayim, put your face against Paro, the king of Mitzrayim, v'hinavei alav, and prophesy against him, v'al Mitzrayim kula, and on the entire Egypt. Daber v'omar ta, speak and say, Ko amar Hashem Elokim, so says Hashem God. Hini alecha Paro melech Mitzrayim, behold I am upon you, Paro, the king of Mitzrayim. Hatanim hagadol, the great, What's Hatanim? Sea monster, crocodile. I would say serpent. The great sea serpent. Hatanim Hagadol. Harovetz Besochia Orav, that crouches in his, it could mean river. We'll talk about this word in a moment. Asher Amar, that he said, that Paro says, Li Yaori, to me is my river. Ani Asisini, and I made me. I made me as great as I am. Now, what river is he talking about?
The Nile.
The Nile River. Okay. It's the Nile River. And what does Paro mean when he says, the river is mine and I have made me?
Because he thinks he's a god as the Nile River.
Okay, so he believes himself to be a deity of some sort, that he is in control. The way Rashi says it is, Paro believes he doesn't need God. He's got everything that he needs. He's got a river that overflows its banks, and as a result, the irrigation is naturally carried out for Egypt, and he doesn't need God. Now, Hashem is going to here have a prophecy against Paro, and it's going to talk about the destruction of Mitzrayim. The question, of course, is why? Why is Egypt going to be destroyed, and why is Paro going to be destroyed? So here we have our first insight, and that would be because
they probably felt joyful when.
Well, it doesn't say that yet. What's the only information we have so far?
Well, he thinks he's a god.
Okay, because he thinks he's a god. We had this before with Hiram and Sar, that he thought that he was a deity. It doesn't say explicitly that Paro thought he was a deity, just that he felt that he was independent. He didn't need God. But at any rate, he's certainly very full of himself, and we know that that's always a prelude to destruction. So that's our first hint. We will see later another reason why Paro and Mitzrayim are going to be destroyed, and we'll get to that in a few psukim. Now let's discuss this one before we go further. First of all, let's discuss the word Ye'or. Ye'or means river. Rashi says in Parashas Miketz, it says that Paro was dreaming. That's where he had those famous dreams, which we're actually going to speak about tonight. But he had those famous dreams about the skinny cows and the large cows, and the skinny cows consumed the large cows, and the years of famine, and the years of plenty, and all that. With Yosef, so there it says, Ufaro Cholem, Paro was dreaming, Vihine Omen Al Ya'or, and he was standing on the Ya'or, the river. Rashi comments over there that only one river is called Ya'or, and that is the Nile. Now the Mefarshim say Rashi doesn't mean of all rivers in the world. Rashi means of the four rivers that are mentioned in Parshas Bereishis that were in Gan Eden. Those are Pishon, Gihon, Chidekel, and Pras. You don't need to remember those. But those are the four that are listed in the verses in the Psukim in Bereishis. One of those, the first one, Pishon, is the Nile River. Of those four, only Pishon, only the Nile, is called Ye'or. Why is it called Ye'or? Because Ye'or actually means little rivulets. Am I pronouncing that word correctly? Mm-hmm. Rivulets. Okay. So that's what Ye'or means.
Little what?
Rivulets.
Rivulets?
Yes.
Little rivulets.
So what is why would the Nile be called that? Because the Egyptians dug many irrigation ditches from the Nile all over the immediate banks of the Nile, and that's where they grew their food on the banks of the Nile, and everything else that they grew was on the banks of the Nile based on those little irrigation ditches. That's why the Nile is called Ye'or, because it doesn't rain in Egypt. Egypt survives on the Nile River overflowing its banks. This is actually mentioned in the Chumash. In the Chumash, it says that Hashem says, Moshe says to the Bnei Yisrael, that the land that Hashem is taking you to is not a land of like in Mitzrayim. It's not like Mitzrayim, where you would use an irrigation ditch in order to water your field. Rather, Limtar Hashamayim Tishtemayim. You'll drink water based on rain from the heavens. Now the Pasuk is saying that as an advantage, because as Rashi explains over there, if you're using irrigation from a river to water your fields, then you can only water that which is lower than the river, because water only flows down. So it can only be lower than the height of the river when it overflows its banks. But you can't water any hill or anything higher up, because the water won't go that way. So you're limited in what you can do, and if you want to water someplace that is higher up, you need to actually fill up buckets of water and walk to where you want and drop the water there, and that's very tedious. While if it rains, as Rashi says, when Hashem makes it rain, everything gets water all at once. The heights, the valleys, everything. And you can be lying in bed, and everything is done for you. Now we know that there's a drawback to relying on rain. And what is that drawback?
Drought.
Drought, God forbid. Right now Israel is going through a terrible time with a lack of water. And that is the drawback. from a broader perspective, when you are dependent on rain, it is a lot easier to associate rain with Hashem. Either it rains or it doesn't rain. And if it doesn't rain, it's a lot easier to understand the reason why it's not raining is because of our actions, and we need to improve, we need to do teshuva, they make fast days, etc., in order to get it to rain. When one is dependent on the river overflowing its banks, even though we know that it should be the same thing, if the river doesn't overflow its banks, why not?
You get
enough
rain.
What's that? You didn't get enough rain further upstream.
Further upstream.
Yeah, but from the perspective of the people just living there, we would know because Hashem is not letting it happen for the same reasons, whatever the reasons are, and therefore it calls for the same type of reaction. Teshuva, fasting, trying to improve so that Hashem will make the water overflow its banks, the river overflow its banks. But it is a lot easier to forget Hashem. And it's a simple matter of geography. Rain comes from upstairs, and the river is down here. So when you're focused on down here, it's a lot easier to ignore Hashem in the equation. When you're thinking about rain, you're looking up to the heavens, it's a lot more difficult to ignore HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Eretz Yisrael, which is dependent on rain, lends itself to looking to the heavens. You look to the heavens for your water source. And if it's not coming down, God forbid, you look to the heavens. But in Egypt, you don't look to the heavens, you look to the ground. It's a perspective that is against God, that is ignoring God. It's a perspective that's focusing on the river. And it becomes an element of Kochi v'otzem yadi, where it's my strength, where Paro can say, I make it happen. It's all about me. That's the broader perspective on the difference between Mitzrayim and Eretz Yisrael. So here, that's precisely what the Yechezkel is saying about Paro, that he claimed, it is my river, and I have made me. I've made me all that I am. I am the one who has made Egypt the great nation that it is. Now, Paro is referred to as a Tanim HaGadol, the great serpent. Anybody know where the first reference to a Tanim is in the Chumash? That is precisely what it is. In Bereishis, it says, right in the first 6 days of creation, it says that Hashem created as HaTaninim HaGidolim, the great Taninim. What are Taninim? Serpents. It's talking about sea creatures, and He created these giant Taninim. So the Livyasan, the Leviathan, is referenced over there. The Taninim are often another word. A Tanim is used as a synonym for the Livyasan. But later in the Chumash, we find the word Tanim used in a less dramatic sense. What does it mean later in the Chumash? It has to do with Paro again.
Next
would
be
template. Okay, but not the 10 plagues, but you're right. When they throw down their staff and it turns into a tanim, turns into a snake. Not a sea serpent, but a snake. So that's what the word tanim means. It means a snake or a serpent or something of that nature. If you say a crocodile, so then it's because it's something that's long like that and it goes in the ocean. That's the idea. So Paro is compared to a large tanim. The time that the Torah uses the word gadol, where it modifies the word tanim with the word gadol, the large tanim, is in Bereishis. It says, ha taninim ha gidolim, the large sea serpents. And as I mentioned, Rashi says over there, that's referring to the Leviathan. So Paro is fancies himself as being this extremely powerful sea creature, the Tanim HaGadol, that's crouching in his river, in the Nile River. That's the reference that's being made here to the Tanim HaGadol, the large serpent. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Shehakol Nivra. Now, as usual, we've seen this several times before, because Paro fancies himself to be in charge of the Nile, and that he is this powerful creature that controls the Nile, Hashem will speak of his downfall using a mashal, using a parable, which builds on his own fanciful dream. Meaning he's going to use that whole idea of Paro being this powerful serpent and bring him down using his own thinking. So that's how we continue in Pasuk Daled, verse 4. V'nasati chachim b'l'chayecha, I'm going to put a hook in your mouth, in your cheek. Meaning the idea, it's to conjure up the idea of catching a fish, right, with a hook, with a metal hook. V'hidbakti degasi orecha bekas kisosecha, and I will make the fish of your river cling to your scales. The fish of your river refers to his subjects, the rest of the people in Egypt. They're going to cling to his scales, meaning that when he's caught, they'll be caught as well. I will pull you out of your river, and all the fish of your river, they will be attached to your scales. And as Rashi says, by pulling a fish out of water, that is how you kill the fish. So, Paro, I'm going to pull you right out of there with all of your subjects, and you will then be destroyed. Unetashticha haminbara, I will lay you out in the desert, in the wilderness. Oschaves kol degasi orecha, you and all the fish of your river. Apnei asadet hipol, on the face of the field you will fall. Lo se asef velo si kavetz, you will not be gathered in, you will not be gathered together. To the beast of the land and to the birds of the heavens, I have given you to be consumed. Meaning, they will not be buried; they will be consumed by the animals and the birds. Why should they be so punished? Meaning, they're not only being destroyed, but they're not even getting a burial; they're being consumed by the animals and the birds. Why should that be? Now we haven't finished yet discussing why they're being destroyed in the first place. But whatever the reason is, why is it that they end up not even being buried?
He's not against the bush because he thinks he's a god. There's no respect to the
burial. It could be that's what it is. The Rashi tells us in Parshas Va'era, actually, Rashi tells us that because Paro said at one point, when he was with all the Makos, all the plagues, at one point he said, Hashem HaTzadik Vani Ve'ami HaRishayim, Hashem is the righteous one and I and my nation are the sinners. That's before he reneged. But at that point he was ready to let the Jews go. So there, because he said Hashem HaTzadik, Rashi says, therefore they deserve to be buried. And later on, when the Egyptians are drowned in the Red Sea, it says Tivla Emo Aretz. In Az Yashar it says Tivla Emo Aretz. The land will swallow them up. Rashi says that's a reference to burial. Hashem made it that when they were drowned, the seabed covered up the bodies, that they did get buried. So that was as a reward, because at least they admitted that Hashem was correct and they were wrong. Hashem atzadik v'ani v'ami harishayim. But in contrast to that, we find that the children of Ham are not usually deserving that type of respect. Back with the three sons of Noach, Shem, Ham, and Yefes, so we know that after the Mabel, after the flood, Noach ended up in his tent, and he was uncovered. And what happened?
They went in.
Who's they?
Ham was the one who first pointed out his brother.
Okay, so Ham did not cover his father up.
No.
And his brothers, Shem and Yefes, they covered him up. Shem and Yefes deserved something because of that. Shem was rewarded. Shem, of course, is our ancestor. Shem was rewarded that his descendants should wear a talis. That was our reward, that we get the mitzvah of tzitzis, because he respected and therefore covered up his father. Yefes, who joined Shem, but it wasn't his idea, but he joined Shem, therefore he deserves a reward as well. And this is very telling. What reward does Yefes get? Later on, it hasn't happened yet, later on, when we have that war of Milchemes Gog u'Magog, which precedes the whatever the future is going to bring, and as we've mentioned many times in this class, we don't know the sequence of events that the future will bring. But whatever is going to be then, there is a war that is supposed to take place called Milchemes Gog u'Magog, where we will learn about it, because it's spoken about in Yechezkel. This is where Gog u'Magog, not tonight, but this is where, this is the book that has the war of Gog u'Magog in it. That war is waged by Gog, who's the king, from the land of Magog. That's what Gog u'Magog is. Gog from Magog. Gog is a descendant of Yefes. And the pasuk says in Yechezkel that after that war is over, and of course he will be defeated, he will be buried. Because since Yefes respected his father Noach and assisted Shem in covering his father up, therefore Yefes deserves that, even though his children will be eventually be killed out, but they will be buried. They'll deserve a burial. But Ham, who defiled his father and did not show him any respect, so Rashi over there says that the punishment is that when they were taken into Golos, into exile, and Mitzrayim are descendants of Ham, they were taken Arum, without clothing, after they were defeated, and they were in tatters, and their clothing were in tatters, they were dragged into exile, unclothed. That was as a punishment to how he treated his father. But another way to understand it is what's being said over here, that the Egyptians, because they are descendants of Ham, do not deserve burial. Where Yefes, his descendants do deserve burial, but Mitzrayim does not. It's only in that case with the Red Sea, where there they did do something to deserve burial, they got burial. But other than that, when they are punished, they lose that basic human dignity of being buried because of the way that their ancestor, Ham, defiled their father. Yeah?
So these days, how are we supposed to look at Egypt, you know?
The Egyptians in Egypt today are not Egyptians. They're not Mitzrim. It's not clear who they are. I mean, it's unlikely. Let's put it that way. It's unlikely that they are Egyptians.
So they're African of some kind.
It would seem that way. All of the nations of the world ended up being moved around by Sancheriv, the king of Ashur, the Assyrian king. He's the one who took the 10 tribes into Golos, into exile. So it's hard to know. Now, the Egyptians at this time seem to still be Egyptians, but they are going to be taken into Golos as well by Nebuchadnezzar, as we'll see in a minute. So today, the Egyptians, it's hard to know whether they really are or aren't. The Rambam does write that he does make Egypt an exception when he says all the nations of the world are not who they are. Whether they're living in those places or not, they're not the original people. He writes that Egypt is an exception. That's going to be based on the psukim we're going to see here in Yechezkel.
But he says that they are.
Well, that was in the time of the Rambam. It's hard to know whether today that's who they are and who's what. You know, we don't know who people are today. We know who we are.
Rambam says yes, that they are the same people.
He writes that. I'm not sure what time frame he's talking about. I mean, you have to remember, he lived 1,000 years ago. slightly under 1,000 years ago. So it's hard to know what time frame he's referring to. Okay, so they will not be buried, though. Instead, they'll be consumed by the beasts and the birds. Pasuk Vav, verse 6. V'yodu kol yoshvei Mitzrayim, and all those who dwell in Egypt will know, ki ani Hashem, that I am God. Yad hayosam mish'enes kane leveis Yisrael. Now, here we get another insight into why they're being destroyed. Because they were a mish'enes kane, a reed. Kane is a reed, and mish'enes means something that you lean on. They were a leaning reed for the Jewish people. Now, if a person needs to lean on something, what do you lean on? What are crutches made out of?
Wood.
Something sturdy. Right? If a person leans on a reed,
it's weak.
It buckles under him and he falls. So the Egyptians at this time were a mish'enes kane. You see, in the twists of history, after we got out of Egypt, we went to Israel, of course. And over 800 years later is where we find ourselves here. At this point, the kings of Israel had made a pact with Egypt because there was the looming danger of Babel, of Babylonia, and people were afraid. And so the Jews and the Egyptians made a pact that if Nebuchadnezzar would come to attack, the Egyptians would help out the Jewish people. In the event, that did not happen. They were expecting the Egyptians to come and help, and they never showed up. So they were a mish'enes kane. They were something to lean on that turned into a reed. They ended up being unfaithful to their guarantee that they would help the Jewish people. They were a mish'enes kane. So as a result, they are going to be punished. And the next pasuk actually elaborates on this mashal, on this parable. B'safsam b'cha bakaf terots, when they grabbed onto you with their hands, you crumbled. Uvakatolahem kol kaseif, and you broke for them all their shoulders. They fell when they were trying to lean on you, and they broke their shoulders. It's uvishanam alecha tishaver, and when they leaned on you, you broke. V'amanatolahem kol masnoyim, and you forced them to stand on their own legs. You forced the Jewish people to stand on their own legs, their own midsection, masnayim. It's because he was trying to lean, and the thing buckled, so he had to catch himself from falling. So the analogy is to a person who was leaning on something, and it gave out from under him. So here we have now two reasons why the Egyptians are being punished. One is because of the way that Paro and the Egyptians thought of themselves, that they were independent of Hashem. And two is because they betrayed the Jewish people, who they were supposed to be an ally with to help them against the Nebuchadnezzar. Now you should know that in Eicha, which we read on Tisha B'Av, which also discusses the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, over there is a pasuk that references this idea that the Egyptians were supposed to come help the Jewish people. And there Rashi brings the Medrash that they were on their way to help, and Hashem they passed by the ocean as they're coming to help the Jewish people. They passed by the Red Sea, and Hashem made things like bobbing up and down in the water. And they saw those things, and they said, "What are those things? Oh, those are the corpses of our ancestors, 800 plus years ago, that they were chasing after the Jewish people and they drowned." And it reminded them of their previous animosity towards the Jews, and they turned around and went home. Now they're still blamed, because they still went back on their treaty. But Hashem didn't want them to come help the Jewish people, because Hashem wanted the Beis HaMikdash to be destroyed. Nevertheless, because they double-crossed the Jews, they also are being punished for it. Pasuk Ches, verse 8. Lachin, therefore, Komar Hashem Elohim, says Hashem God. Hinani mevi alayich charev, I'm bringing upon you the sword. V'yichatim imech adamu v'heimah, and I will cut off from you man and beast. Vayisa Eretz Mitzrayim lishmama v'charba, and the land of Egypt will be desolate and destroyed. V'yad'u ki ani Hashem, they will know that I am God. Yan amar yor li v'ani asisi, because he said, it is my river, I have made me. V'chein hinini eilecha v'al yarecha, therefore I am against you and against your river. V'nasati es Eretz Mitzrayim l'charvos chorev shmama, and I will make Eretz Mitzrayim to be a destruction of desolation. Mimigdol Sveinei Vad Gul Kush. From, these are the boundaries of Egypt, from Migdol Sveinei, which is a place, until the boundary of Kush of Ethiopia. That was the boundary between Egypt and the next country, which is Ethiopia. that which Kush is a neighbor of Mitzrayim is also brought out in Parashas Va'era, because, and this is good to know for the Seder, this is a nice thing to say over, almost time to talk about Pesach. Mm-hmm. Purim first, but you know that 30 days before Pesach is supposed to start talking about Pesach. When is 30 days before Pesach? Purim. So at the Purim Suda, you're supposed to make mention of Pesach. I know the women don't want to hear that. but that you're supposed to make mention of it because you're 30 days before Pesach. At any rate, the different makos, the different plagues that came against the Egyptians, were miraculous in that they only affected Egyptian soil. So that, for instance, the frogs or the lice only went on Egyptian soil. They didn't go anywhere else, especially the lice, which covered the Egyptian soil. So one of the miracles was that as soon as you got to the border between Egypt and Kush, they stopped. They didn't go into Kush. And it settled border disputes. There had been border disputes between Kush and Mitzrayim, and wherever the Kinem went, you knew it was Egypt. And where they didn't go, you knew it was Kush. It's an interesting thing the Medrash says.
So those times that was true? I mean, are there still critters there now?
No. They went away after the Makkah was over. But yeah, but at that time, it settled some border disputes that they had. Yud Aleph 11. Lo savor ba regal adam. No footsteps of man will pass through Egypt. Virago behemah lo savor ba, and no footsteps of animals will pass through it. V'lo say shev arba'im shana, and they will not be settled for 40 years. For 40 years, Egypt will be desolate. And then it will be resettled. We're going to get back to this 40 years in a moment. I will make the land of Egypt desolate within lands that are desolate. And its cities will be amongst other destroyed cities. They will be desolate. 40 years. And I will scatter the Egyptians amongst the nations. Another word for scatter, amongst the lands. Kikomar Hashem Elokim, for so says Hashem God. Mikaith Arboim Shana, after 40 years, Akabefes Mitzrayim Mino Amim Hashana Fotsu Shama. I will gather the Egyptians from the nations that they have been scattered there. Mishavtias Shvus Mitzrayim, I will resettle the settling of Egypt. Vashivosi, or some Eretz Pasros, and I will return them to the land of Pasros, which is the land of Egypt. Eretz Mechura Sam, the land that they sojourned in. They will be there, a lowly kingdom. Yes, Egypt will end up coming back, they'll be resettled, but they will be a lowly kingdom. No longer will the Egyptians be a powerful nation. Amongst the kingdoms, it will be lowly. It will no longer rule over the nations. I will diminish them, that they should no longer control the nations. They will no longer be for the Jewish people as something they can rely on to remind of their sins. When the Jews turn after them, they will know that I am Hashem God. So Hashem says the Egyptians will no longer be able to double cross the Jewish people, because they'll no longer be able to be a nation that anybody would want to ally themselves with, because they will be a lowly nation. Now, why 40 years? So this is a fascinating thing. Why 40 years? We know that Paro, the original Paro, had two dreams. He dreamt about cows and about sheaves of wheat. And we know that Yosef was asked to interpret them. And what did he say?
You know, 7 good years and then the 7 famine years.
Right. First of 7 years of plenty, and then 7 years of famine. That's 14 years total. Right. It's 14 years total, 7 years of plenty, and then 7 years of famine. Now, the 7 years of plenty went by, and then came the 7 years of famine. And when that started, how many of them happened before Yaakov came?
Two years.
There were 2 years that when Yosef finally reveals himself to his brothers, he says, go tell my father Yaakov to come down to Egypt, because, he says this explicitly in Parashas Vayigash, because 2 years have passed from the famine, and there's another 5 years that are going to happen before the famine is over. That's what Yosef says to his brothers. However, when Yaakov came to Mitzrayim, all of a sudden things started to grow again. And that was because it was Ba Bracha L'Raglav. Yaakov brought blessing to Egypt when he walked into Egypt. That is why when Yaakov dies on his deathbed, he makes Yosef swear to go bury him in Eretz Yisrael. Because Yaakov is afraid they're going to make him into a deity, because he's the one who ended the famine. Everybody realized that it wasn't an obscure thing. It wasn't like, oh, the famine ended. Maybe Yosef was really lying. It wasn't supposed to be 7 years. It was only 2 years. Maybe Yosef made a mistake. Nobody thought that, because it was so obvious. Wherever he walked, things started to grow. It was clear and obvious that it was from Yaakov that the famine ended. Now, the different commentaries discuss what happened after Yaakov died. Some say that the additional 5 years of famine came back after Yaakov died. There was only a delay when he came down. But there were still 5 more years of famine to take place 17 years later after Yaakov dies. That's what some of the commentaries say. The Medrash says that if you look in the Psukim in Parashas Miketz, where the dreams are first mentioned, the dreams about the skinny cows, which represent the lean years, the years of famine, you have 6 references to those dreams. You have the skinny cows and the skinny sheaves of wheat. That's 2. You have it when Paro dreams them. Then you have them twice more, each of them once more, one more time, when Paro relates what he saw to Yosef. He repeats it and he says, I saw 7 skinny cows and 7 skinny sheaves. That's 4. And then, when Yosef is interpreting the dreams, he says, and the 7 cows, the skinny, 7 skinny cows and the 7 skinny sheaves, this is what it means. It means 7 years of famine. So you end up with 6 references to 7 skinny items. 7 times 6 is 42. 2 years happened already. That means that there were 40 years left of famine. Or if not famine, of desolation. Those 40 years, the Medrash says, and Rashi cites it, take place over here. That's why when Egypt finally does get destroyed, it is a 40-year desolation. That's where it comes from. And then Hashem is going to bring back the Egyptians. Now we need to keep these 40 years in mind, as we'll see in a moment. We're gonna get back into these years. They're going to be very crucial as we move along.
So the 6 references times the 7 years of
famine. Right. There's 6 references to 7.
Why is it that the Egyptians are idol worshippers? How can they actually make the connection with Yaakov?
It was too obvious. I mean, they treated Yaakov with great deference.
Along the head reality, but when you don't want to see it, it's hard for me to believe.
They were afraid of him. I mean, he was Yaakov was a he was an awesome person. He had a presence, and they were afraid of him. And we find it even in Eastern Europe, where the non-Jews were typically terribly anti-Semitic, but there were certain great Jews who were given great deference by the non-Jews. Certain graves that they wouldn't dare defile. So, you know, things like that, because they were afraid. There were certain people that just, their presence was terrifying to them. And Yaakov was that kind of presence. Pasuk Yudzayin 17. Now we fast forward. Vayehi be'esrin l'sheva shana. And it was in the 27th year. Now, 27th year from what? Before we said this was the 10th year, we meant the 10th year from the time that the first of the two waves of exile took place. From the first time that a group of people was taken into exile. So let's get the year straight again. Nebuchadnezzar took power in year 1. We'll call that year 1. Year 2, he conquers Israel for the first time. In year 8 of his reign, that's when he took Yechezkel and Mordechai and Esther and Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, all the great people, he took them into Galus, into exile. But he did not destroy the Beis HaMikdash. That was his year 8. His year 19 is when he actually destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. Now we're talking about his year 27. This is fast forwarding to 8 years after the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. Now we haven't discussed the Beis HaMikdash being destroyed, but we've jumped ahead 8 years after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. So in the 27th year of Nebuchadnezzar, Barishon, in the first month, Be'echad LaChodesh, on the first day of the month, Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Now remember this. Wherever you see Rosh Chodesh Nisan in Tanakh, you assume that it's good for the Jews. Rosh Chodesh Nisan is a good time for us. So if this prophecy takes place on the first day of Nisan, then it's significant and it's something good for us, usually. That'll be the case. If it's not, you have to explain why. Hayad var Hashem Elai Lemor, the word of Hashem was to me saying, Ben Adam, son of man, Nebuchadrezzar Melech Bavel, Nebuchadrezzar, sometimes he's called Nebuchadnezzar and sometimes he's called Nebuchadrezzar. It's the same person. The king of Bavel. He'evines chelo avodah gidolah el tzor. He made his army work very hard against Tsar, which we just learned about, against Tyre. Korosh mukrach, every head, literally this means is balded, but it means that they had to work very hard. They had to carry heavy loads, and they had to work very hard. V'chol kasef miruta, every shoulder is torn up from carrying heavy loads. The shoulders get worn out. But they got no reward from Tsar for the work that they did against it. Remember, Hashem had said that Tsar was going to be destroyed. And he brought Nebuchadnezzar against Tsar and destroyed Tsar. But as soon as Tsar was destroyed, and remember, Tsar was that fabulously wealthy city with incredible booty that they could have walked off with. And just as they were about to do it, a huge wave came from the ocean and inundated Tsar. And there was nothing left. Nebuchadnezzar walked away from Tsar, and his army walked away from Tsar with nothing. Lachain, therefore, Kamar Hashem, Elokim says as Hashem God, Hineni nosim l'Nebuchadnezzar melech Bavel es eretz Mitzrayim. Behold, I am going to give to Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Bavel, the land of Mitzrayim. V'nasa hamona, he will take all its multitudes, v'shalal shalal, and he will take its booty, uvazaz biza, another word for booty, v'aysa sachar l'chelowi will be his reward for his nation, for his army. Pula so asher avad ba, his work that he did against it. Nasati lo asher etz Mitzrayim, I have given him the land of Mitzrayim. Asher asu li, that they, because of what they, Mitzrayim, did against me. Nuum Hashem Elokim, so says Hashem God. Here we have one of the few insights into how Hashem moves things around in the world, and everybody gets what they deserve. Hatsur tamim pa'alo, Hashem is fair, is completely fair, even though we don't see it. But sometimes we get an insight, and here we do. When was Tsar destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar? Tsar was destroyed in the 20... Hold on. It happened, I believe, in the 24th year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. No, the 23rd year of his reign. In the 23rd year of his reign, that is when Nebuchadnezzar conquered Tsar. 4 years after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, that's when Tsar was destroyed. And they got nothing. 3 years later, 3 years later, is that right? Yeah, no, 4 years later, I'm going to mix it with 23, 24. 4 years later, in his 27th year, Hashem brings Nebuchadnezzar against Mitzrayim. Why against Mitzrayim? Because Mitzrayim double-crossed the Jewish people. So he brings Nebuchadnezzar to punish Mitzrayim, and by taking the booty of Mitzrayim, now Nebuchadnezzar and his army are rewarded for what they did against Tsar, which is what Hashem wanted to happen in the first place. So it took 4 years, but eventually they got their booty. They got their wealth because of the destruction of Tsar. So Hashem has moved nations and armies around, and everybody is getting what they deserve. Tsar is getting destroyed, Mitzrayim is getting destroyed, and Nebuchadnezzar's army is getting paid for their work. Notice, in the pasuk we just read, pasuk Chaf, it says, Asher asu li, that they did, meaning Mitzrayim did against me. Rashi explains that this is one of those references where Hashem says, if you attack my people, it's like you're attacking me. Asher asu li is the fact that Mitzrayim double-crossed the Jewish people. Hashem says, you double-crossed the Jewish people, that's like you're double-crossing me. I consider that like you came against me and attacked me. So that's the Asher Asuli they did to me. That's why Nebuchadnezzar attacks and conquers Mitzrayim. And finally, Chaf Aleph, Bayomahu, on that day, which is the day that, we'll see what that day means, Atzmiach Keren Leves Yisrael, I will plant or make blossom the horn for the Jewish people, which means that the Jewish people are going to begin their being extricated from the gullus, from the exile. And to you, Yechezkel, I will give an ability to open your mouth amongst them, which means that they will see that your nevuah is coming true, and therefore, you know, he's saying this nevuah years in advance, and it'll take place anyway. They will all see that what you're saying is true. V'yaduki ani Hashem, they will know that I am God. So what is Bayomahu on that day? Rashi is very puzzled by this, because what do you mean on that day? On that day, how will there be a blossoming of the horn of Beis Yisrael? We're talking here on the 27th year of Nebuchadnezzar, which is only 8 years after the destruction. We know that how long were they in Gullus? From the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash until the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash? How many years? 70 years. This is only 8 years. They got another 62 to go. So how can this, in fact, the Purim story is the very tail end of those 70 years, but it's much later. So what does it mean on that day there'll be a blossoming of the Jewish people? So, it might have a deeper meaning, but let's deal with the simple meaning first. So Rashi says, Bayom Ahu on that day does not mean when Nebuchadnezzar defeats Mitzrayim, which is in his 27th year. It means on that day that Egypt gets resettled 40 years later after its destruction. In other words, this happens in the year 27 of Nebuchadnezzar, which is 8 years after the destruction. Add 40 years. The 48th year after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, we will then see the blossoming of the Jewish people. Now, what do you mean? They still have another 22 years to go. 48 plus 22 is 70. They have 22 years to go after Mitzrayim gets resettled. Nebuchadnezzar is the one who defeated, who conquered and destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. He is succeeded by his son, Evil-Merodach. He's the one who succeeds Nebuchadnezzar as king. Evil-Merodach is succeeded by Belshazzar. Belshazzar is the famous king that had the writing on the wall that happens in Belshazzar's time, which is discussed in Sefer Daniel, because Daniel is the one who reads the writing on the wall, and he explains what it means. Belshazzar is the first one to make the mistake that eventually Ahasuerus makes. He is the one who takes the utensils, the utensils of the Beis HaMikdash and the garments of the Kohen Gadol out, and he wears them and uses the utensils in a party because he thinks the 70 years are over. And of course, that is his demise. Ahasuerus does the same thing. They each make a mistake. The Gemara explains how Belshazzar made a mistake in his count of the 70 years, and Ahasuerus made a mistake in his count of the 70 years, but they're each making a mistake in counting those 70 years. They're all waiting for the 70 years to be up. Belshazzar becomes king on the day, or that time, when Mitzrayim gets resettled. The 48th year after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, that's when Belshazzar takes over as king. And Daniel has a prophecy then, and his prophecy then is that the Persians, Paras, will defeat the Kastim, will defeat the Babylonians, the Nebuchadnezzar's, now it's Belshazzar. That's when the prophecy happens, that they will be defeated. And 3 years later, that's what happens. The Persians taking over is the Tzmichas Keren for the Jewish people. Because it is when the Persians take over, when we go back and rebuild the temple, who is in control of the known world, of the main part of the world at that time? It is the Persians. The Persians have replaced the Babylonians as the major power in the world. And it is that changing of power that eventually leads to the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. So the Bayalahu means at that time means the 48th year when Egypt is resettled, that's when Persia also, when Daniel has his prophecy that the Persians will defeat and take over from the Babylonians as the major power of the world. So that's what it means. On that day, there will be a Tzmichas Keren for the Jewish people. There's a lot more to talk about on this chapter. We're obviously doing it quickly, and we don't have time to get into all the details. But this is one of those prakim that has a lot to do with the whole system of how things are working in exile. Now we're going to talk in more detail as we move along to what happened in this exile with Nebuchadnezzar, with Eva Merudach, with Belshazzar. Eventually he is replaced. Achashverosh, that whole story, which is the Purim story, all of that is part of the exile. We're not really there yet. We fast forwarded, because we haven't even discussed the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. But because we got into Egypt, we fast forwarded to talk about the turnaround as well. You have a question?
Wasn't Persia good for the Jews? Like, weren't we allowed to be Jews and...
Well, we to an extent. It was better for us than under the Babylonians. Yeah. Now, we'll leave you with one last thing, and I do have to run out. I have an appointment at 9. But I do want to leave you with one last thought. I mentioned about the first day of Nisan. I remember sitting in a dentist's office, waiting room, and reading it was probably a U.S. News and World Report or something like that, many years ago, about the meteors that were going to strike Jupiter. That took place how many years ago already? It was the early 90s when it happened. So that whole episode troubled me, because when the planets get struck, the Gemara says it's a bad sign. When it's a bad sign for the world when the planets get hit, especially planets that are visible to the naked eye like Jupiter. So not only that, but that took place on Tisha B'Av. Now it took place over a few days, but it ran over Tisha B'Av when it happened. So to me, it was a startling thing and something to be concerned about. So I had been thinking about this is before it happened, but they had already predicted when it was all going to take place, and I had been thinking heavily about it. And I was in that dentist's office, and I was reading an article, and the article happened to mention the day or the evening when that meteor, or whatever it's called, was discovered. It was discovered by amateur astronomers, and it was discovered on a particular night, and it was discovered simultaneously. They discovered it, and they got to register it first, but there was another place, like another part of the world, they also discovered it, right? So I noticed that it was springtime when it was discovered. So I dated it back in the Hebrew dates, and it came out to Rosh Chodesh Nisan. So the discovery of it was Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Even though it hit Jupiter around Tisha B'Av, but the discovery was on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. And that put my thoughts at ease. I don't know what it means. I don't know what it's all about. I'm not a prophet. But the fact is, it was discovered Rosh Chodesh Nisan, and then it struck on Tisha B'Av. Also, after it struck on Tisha B'Av, it struck, I believe, the first strike was Tisha B'Av. It could have been the 8th of Av, but it was right around then. But it went on for several days, and it went all the way until Tu B'Av, till the 15th of Av, which is a holiday. So, for whatever, I don't know what the significance of it was, is, I have no idea. But the fact of the matter is that the dates, which were troubling to me, have some silver lining to it. Rosh Chodesh Av and Rosh Chodesh Nisan and Tu B'Av.